Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly 3/4 of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello and welcome to the Red Box Politics Podcast in the Times. I'm Matt Chorley. This week I want to talk about people who do politics, but not as we know it. Not the politicians or the think tanks, or even, dare I say it, the journalists. But how does someone bring about change in policy or even the law, but outside the political party system? What role is technology playing in that? And what should the response be to the rise in youth engagement in the political process? As ever, do get in touch and let us know what you think of the podcast. Email redbox@thetimes.co.uk or tweet at timesredbox. And no one's posted a review on iTunes for ages, so if you say something nice about us, I'll give you a mention next week. Right then, down to business. My guests this week are David Babbs from the online petition website 38 Degrees, campaigner Caroline Criado-Perez, whose many successes include getting a woman on the £10 note, and Matteo Bergamini from the youth politics website Shout Out UK. Welcome to you all, and we begin with David Babbs.
Politics today is more about which issues you care about than what party you belong to. Technology enables people to unite around common concerns to influence decision makers. And with a minority government and huge divisions within political parties, people power can have a big, positive influence over how we do Brexit.
So David, just explain to people who don't know what 38 Degrees is and what you do and why you do it.
So 38 Degrees is, at its heart, is a network of ordinary citizens across the UK, about 3 million of us, who decide together using the internet which issues we want to campaign on, and then come together to choose different tactics, different strategies to try and make that change happen. So often people encounter us first by signing an online petition on the 38 Degrees website, but then subsequently we'll go on to do all kinds of other things, whether it's contacting their member of parliament, going to visit their member of parliament, hosting a discussion in their local area, writing to their local newspaper, or chipping in to fund research or investigations or opinion polling to help boost the campaign issue.
And so how does a petition come about? Because you're right, you know, people see shared on Twitter and Facebook, you know, sign this petition. How does that petition come about? Has there been a sort of democratic process before? Or is it just one person can set that up?
So there are two ways a campaign can start at 38 Degrees. One is that we've got a small staff team based in London and Edinburgh, and every week we're surveying the 38 Degrees membership, asking them what issues they'd like to campaign about. And we sit down each Monday looking at all the suggestions that have come in, and we create, as a staff team, campaigns for our members to get involved in. However, members also have the opportunity to short circuit that whole process and go onto the website and start their own campaigns. And I'd say the campaigns that we push most heavily probably are about an even split of campaigns that have been created by members or campaigns which have been created by staff, informed by the democratic participation of 38 Degrees members.
And what would you just sort of single out as being your sort of greatest hits? What's the ones that have had the biggest impact?
Well, right now, I think we're having quite a big impact on the debate around delegated powers, statutory instruments, Henry VIII clauses, as we're calling them, within the EU withdrawal bill. I think we played a big role in persuading George Osborne to back off on cuts to tax credits a couple of years ago. Probably the issue that we first grew to people's attention with was a campaign a few years ago to persuade the coalition government to drop plans to sell off England's forests.
I do remember that well. And that, from a journalist point of view, that was the first time that I'd sort of come across.
Yeah, that was, I think, when we hit escape velocity and I guess proved that we could really, by enabling lots of people to come together, we could really challenge the government on a policy that they were defending to the hilt and get them to ultimately stand up in Parliament and admit it was a bad idea.
I was, whenever I think of 38 degrees, I always think of lots of NHS campaigns.
Yeah, no, that's true. I think there are lots of local campaigns on the NHS. So there are hospitals still open around the country, thanks to campaigns that 38 degrees members have got involved in. And then also lots of efforts to push for more funding for the NHS, to secure some amendments to Andrew Lansley's reorganisation of the NHS. But I guess I didn't list that as a runaway success, because I don't think we would feel we secured quite as many amendments to Andrew Lansley's NHS plans as we would have liked.
The pause, when they paused the bill to sort of stop and take stock, that was a time of 38 degrees. That was all around the time of Forest and sort of general U-turn mania in the coalition government.
Certainly the pause had our paw prints on it.
Yeah. Now, just...
Oh, my God.
We could always edit that out later.
But did you come up with it just then?
Yes.
Okay, as long as it wasn't rehearsed, that's the main thing.
Now, I don't know if this is right. Is 38 degrees, does it take its name from the angle at which snowflakes come together to form an avalanche?
Well, the angle of a slope at which an avalanche is most likely to start. So it's like the tipping point angle for snow. Though snow experts have been in touch to say it depends on a lot of geological and atmospheric conditions. But that would make a poor website name.
Now, I imagine that when that sort of came about, the word snowflake didn't have the connotations that it does now, because that was just frozen water falling out of the sky. Do you worry about being sort of too party political? Or is that just inevitable? If you are essentially always campaigning against the government, you're always going to look like you're being anti whichever party's in government at the time.
I think it's definitely true that as a mechanism for accountability and for ordinary people to challenge the government, that whoever is in government is going to find 38 degrees at times a bit annoying. on the other hand, when I speak to our members about what they value about 38 degrees, our independence from political parties is always very close to or at the top of their list. And I think a lot of MPs, including from the Conservative Party, even though they might see we're find us annoying on occasion when we're challenging them to do something which is difficult for them to do or that they don't wish to do, I think a lot of them would recognise at the same time that we play a role in democracy, and they'd recognise that independence. I mean, just in the last week, 38 Degrees members voted to back Kevin Hollenrake MP, a Conservative MP's private members bill, because they agreed with what it was about. It was about extending parental leave to parents who'd lost a child in tragic circumstances. And, you know, I think to our members, it didn't really matter what party an MP was from. It was about the issue that of course, someone who's just lost a child shouldn't be in danger of losing their job or struggling to make the rent because they can't make it into work the next day.
Matteo, given a lot of what you do is sort of focus at younger people, it is true to say that most people don't go around and spend their whole time thinking, I am a Tory, and therefore I agree entirely with everything the Tories are doing and not with the Labour Party. And this sort of move to sort of more issue-based politics.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's always going to be a small percentage of people that are sort of religious when it comes to political parties and sort of pray to the gods of other Conservatives or Labour, or whatever those may be. But I think more young people are moving towards more, definitely more issue-based politics. And I think you saw that at the last snap election. And I think things like 30 degrees and what you guys do sort of resonates a lot with young people, because you're tackling the issues regardless of where those issues or where those campaigns come from, be it Conservatives, Labour, or God forbid, UKIP.
I think I'd go even a bit further of that, but I think one of the things that a lot of people find most frustrating about the way Westminster politics happens is too much adherence to party line, that sense of party line and partisanship obscuring finding common ground or just having a sensible discussion, admitting when you're wrong about something.
Mm. And actually, I think one the example you use of the private members bill on parental leave, they've also done the same thing with the Chris Bryant private members bill on protection for emergency workers. And I think it's a small effort by Number 10 to look like they are reaching out beyond the normal sort of... And also, if you've got a slim or non-existent majority in the Commons, you need to do a bit of that.
Yeah.
And you're right. Most people would be completely baffled by the idea. Well, it's not a Labour or a Tory idea that police officers shouldn't be beaten up in the street. So, or paramedics, whatever.
Precisely. And I think that's why 38 Degrees members voted to support both those campaigns.
But I do think that there needs to be, you know, a placing of the issues within an overall structure of how you understand society. And there could be a danger of things becoming too atomized. You can't just focus on little issues without being aware of how they tie into a bigger, let's say, economic argument. And I think that's where political parties will always be important, because they will be rooted in a certain way of viewing the world and how they want it to change.
And also, presumably, to what extent do you sort of police the content of the petitions? Because you could, I mean, as we've seen in recent days when there's a row about the welfare system, you can draw up a petition which makes it sound absolutely terrible, and then the government can draw up a position about exactly the same system, which doesn't sound so bad at all. So to what extent do you sort of police, well, what you haven't done there is you haven't taken into account this, this and this, or do, is it up to users to do that?
We do a bit of policing, because we have a set of values as an organisation. We're not just a kind of neutral platform. We are seeking to make the UK a fairer, more democratic, nicer place to live. And so we wouldn't allow any petition on our site which was hateful.
Yeah.
That's obviously a problem in some parts of the way that politics happens on the internet, and that's not something we want on our site. We definitely would not have something up that was inaccurate or deliberately misleading. Yeah. I remember sitting in the 38 Degrees office thinking, why do our members want us to campaign so much about forests? Surely the NHS would be a bigger priority for them, but went with what they voted for. A few months later was lapping up praise as a strategic genius for identifying that campaign, and we also went on to have a big impact on the NHS. So I think there's a mindset thing here that again is part of why so many people find Westminster politics so frustrating, that there's kind of quite a narrow group of people who think they have all the answers.
I think that's what turned a lot of people off politics in the past as well, where you've got this sort of insular almost vanguard of people that see party politics as almost like the be all and end all, and it's, you know, we disagree with you because you're red and we're blue and we think this way and you think that way. Whereas obviously politics is a lot more than that, and to taking single issues is not the be all of politics as well. You know, we need political parties that create the sort of grander scheme of things and so forth. But I think it's important to look at those single issues which sometimes get left out of the conversation or get pushed aside because of party line.
Just before we move on from this, what are the sort of slightly obscure issues which are bubbling up at the moment that could be the new forest, the things that you're saying, I'm not sure we should be?
The one that I thought was going to be obscure was the delegated legislation within the EU withdrawal bill, which I never in a million years thought that we'd be involving over 500,000 people in a campaign about statutory instruments. When you talk to people like the Hansard Society, who've been banging on about this stuff for decades, they can't believe it either.
Well, it's fascinating stuff. Let's move on then. That's the sort of the upside of technology, but let's move on and look at some of the downsides that come with that. And this is Caroline.
Pre-social media, campaigning was tough, often thankless, and all but impossible for an individual without the backing of a big organisation. The only real recourse was to approach your local MP or maybe your local paper. Social media has transformed that power dynamic and made it easier for someone with little official or structural power to bring together politicians across party lines, make a splash in the media, and ultimately to make a change. But just as campaigners have been given a voice, so have those who want to retain the status quo and are prepared to threaten violence to do so.
I said at the beginning you were probably best known for getting a woman on the £10 note, which later became Jane Austen. Just talk about how that came about. How did you sort of find yourself? I presume you didn't get up one morning and say, I'm going to become the face of a national campaign that will ultimately see Jane Austen on a £10 note.
No. No. And in fact, that's never how any of the sort of campaigns that I run start. They always start with me getting angry about something and just sort of... And it always has to be something that I just think is so ridiculous that I can't understand how this decision has been taken. I don't really know why. I think it's that galvanizes me into action, because I just can't cope with the idea of such stupidity. So the idea that, or the revelation that the bank was going to remove the only female historical figure we had from the back of our banknotes and replace her with Winston Churchill, just felt to me like such an obvious example of someone not thinking this through, not thinking through the decision. So I decided to challenge the decision, and I started a campaign, or I started a petition on change.org. Sorry, David. You didn't do right. those Next petitions.
Time. All of those sorts of sites, and even the official Parliament petition website, is cluttered with petitions which have 50 signatures or, you know, yeah. So how do you then get to a place where it sort of takes off? Apart from obviously the strong and power of yeah. the argument, but how do you as an individual, you're not a politician or like you said, you're not part of a big organisation. Yeah. So how do you get that to take off?
Well, Twitter's really important. I'm in a slightly different position because I do also write as well. Mm. I was sort of quite low profile, and Twitter just enables you to get the message out. And what is really, really important is that it's not just getting the message out to ordinary people, although that is important. It's getting the message out to journalists. Mm. Because what I think a lot of people who, if there are still people who sort of scoff at Twitter and say, oh, it's just people posting about their breakfast.
Well, it's Instagram.
Yeah, it's Instagram now. See, I don't know. I use Instagram for pictures of my dog. The great thing about Twitter is that all the journalists are on Twitter, and the media still has huge power in this country, a huge power to get messages out and to get people to make a difference. The difference with Twitter is that instead of the media deciding what the story is, Twitter can help push them towards what that story is.
I think you're right. And from a journalist's perspective, in the sort of old days, pre-Twitter and social media and that sort of thing, you'd have, even when I was working on a local paper, somebody would come in and they've got a petition, and, you know, it was a couple hundred signatures. You just sort of think, well, you're just one of, even in a town like Taunton where I was working, you were one of loads of people who had a petition, you know, mm-hmm. But what Twitter can do is show a journalist, this is taking off. I can yeah. see, you know, other people tweeting about how many retweets it's got, and that, you know, so yeah. it provides that sort of visual sense of something taking off.
Yeah, I think it's harder to get your petition noticed now.
Is that right, do you think, David?
A petition rarely wins a campaign on its own. A petition plays two roles.
Oh, absolutely.
It plays the role of it. It's like, it demonstrates a large body of public support, which is often a valuable precondition for winning a campaign. But secondly, it's a way in for people who can then be invited to participate in other forms of action and be taken on a journey with yeah. that campaign.
I think a lot of people don't realise that. It is something I find slightly frustrating about when people start petitions, is that a lot of people seem to think that if they just do a petition, the change will happen. And that's not, you know, of course that's not how it works. I mean, the great thing about these petition websites is, of course, you can get the word out and it's online and people can see that other people have been signing it. But actually the most important thing about petitions is that it's just a massive database for a campaigner. That's the really important thing. So you have the contact details of all these people who've said, I really care about this issue. And then you can mobilize them to tweet their MP, to write letters to their MP, to turn up to demonstrations. You know, if you're just thinking of the petition in the way that it used to be, which was just, you know, a piece of paper.
On a clipboard, which was then sort of posted to the council.
Exactly. Or whatever, yeah. Then, you know, that's not what a petition is anymore. Yeah. A petition is basically a database.
But then, as you alluded to in your intro, there's a downside to this technology, and to Twitter in particular, and the dreadful abuse that you've received while you've been doing a perfectly straightforward campaign about banknotes. Mm. At what point did that sort of start happening? Did it sort of happen immediately, or just talk us through sort of...
So I would say that during the campaign, I got what I would classify as trolling, which is just sort of time-wasting sexism, you know, get back in the kitchen, make me a sandwich, that kind of thing. Or repeatedly explaining to me that there is, in fact, the Queen on a banknote, because being a woman, I can't turn a banknote over and see that she's there.
And woman's plenty. I mean, let's not go
one,
mad.
Exactly. I mean, you're never allowed more than one. So there was that. And obviously, you know, that's just irritating, but whatever. It was once the campaign was successful that I got my first rape threat. And that came, I think, on the day that the campaign win was announced, that the Bank of England had their event at Chawton House and unveiled the Jane Austen banknote. And that was unpleasant. But I don't think it was until the next day that it really, really took off. And I just remember sitting at home, looking at my screen and just seeing all these threats really graphic, detailed rape and death threats, mutilation threats, about how I was, you know, which bits of my body were going to be violated and using what, and how I was going to be tortured to death. And just this, it was just horrifying, you know, just seeing it all stream in and just realizing this is so much, there's so many people who want to rape me.
And yeah. What do you do in that situation?
Well, I started crying.
Yeah. I could have there's an immediate emotional reaction, obviously.
I called my boyfriend at the time and was like, you have to come home. I can't cope with this. I've forgotten your question. Sorry.
I sort of
get a bit lost when I talk about
this. Yeah, of course.
Stuff.
Yeah, I completely. And I don't want to make you sort of go through it all again, but I think it's when people talk about how brilliant Twitter is and the internet, you know, and it is for campaigning and it gives people a voice, but unfortunately, it also gives a voice to some of the most dreadful people in the country.
You know, I mean, I think overall, I would say that it's a good thing. So when that happened, Twitter was completely not set up to deal with that kind of abuse. They didn't have a report abuse button. In order to report any kind of tweet, you had to go to this separate page and fill in this whole form for each tweet. When you're getting like 100 tweets a minute, you just, you know, you can't do it. So I couldn't report anything. And even if I had somehow the time to be able to report every single one, you know, you had to type out what the tweet said. I didn't want to type out, you know, well, I won't repeat what was said, but, you know, I didn't want to type that out. Twitter's evolved since then. And I sort of feel like this links a little bit to what you were saying about there being people, you know, this small section of people at Westminster or this small section of people creating social media who have a particular perspective, who have a particular life experience. The people at Twitter didn't deliberately set up a platform that would make it incredibly easy for people to bombard women with rape and death threats. But that is what they created.
But that's what happened, yeah.
Because it didn't occur to them that that was what was going to happen. And so they hadn't put those checks in place and they hadn't put the ability for women to deal with it. And they've got a lot better since then. Women have been given a voice and people are now aware that actually this is a huge problem. You know, for example, what's going on at the moment with the Harvey Weinstein stuff and the Me Too hashtag. Suddenly a lot of people are aware, no, pretty much every woman you know has been sexually assaulted. In that way, I think that overall it's better. It's been better for politics. There is a pretty high price to pay for people like me who want to do it. And going into that campaign, no, obviously I didn't realise I was going to get rape and death threats. I would still do it again.
Well, that was going to be my next question.
I would still do that campaign again.
Does it worry you that your experience, because you've talked about it completely understandably and you've brought about change with Twitter, this puts people off?
Of course it does. I had so many women getting in touch with me when I was getting all the rape and death threats saying, I just don't dare say anything. You know, you have to think about why these men were so threatened by ultimately a line drawing on a piece of paper. And what that's about is the type of man who feels that the public realm belongs to him. And he's growing up and seeing, oh, but there are all these women here. We're going to have two women on a banknote. And feels very, very threatened, because, you know, the way we bring up boys and men tells them that they need to be the dominant ones. Our culture is permeated by men. It is dominated by men. And so when there is a tiny little incursion of women, it is seen as a threat. And the only way for it not to be seen as a threat is for it to become normal.
Yeah.
So we have to keep doing
this.
Because until it's just completely normal for a woman to be a politician or a woman to be anything, and you don't have to say female politician, this is going to carry on happening.
No, I completely agree. I see it both in journalism and in politics. And you're completely right that until you sort of just have to hope that there are enough women who'll keep buggering on until it becomes normal.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, and I've seen that, you know, both journalists and politicians and the abuse that they get, and it's just appalling. Mm. Let's hope that changes. Let's move on, though. Let's talk about young people and educating them in the political process. And this is Matteo.
It's becoming more important for politics to become a compulsory subject in schools so that young people have a broader understanding of politics, which would then encourage them to vote in elections. It's interesting to look at how young people voted in this election. It seems as though young people vote for policies, not parties. And we want to question, is this the best way of voting? And what age should politics be taught in schools?
So again, I find this a really fascinating topic. And I've got a 16-year-old daughter at home who is sort of interested in politics, but not really. And I sort of feel, you know, I keep trying to prod her to be a bit more interested. But before we get onto that, just explain to listeners what Shout Out UK is.
Sure. So we're a youth news network that tries to get more young people engaged and involved in politics. We use journalism and education as a means of doing that. So on the journalism, we've got a website. It's all user-generated content from 15 to 25-year-olds that allows them to write about issues that they care about. So talking about problems, concerns, or just topics that they find interesting and they want to highlight. It's all edited by our editors in-house so that we check for facts, grammar, spelling, etc., just as best we can as a small startup.
That's better than lots of quite major news websites checking facts and spelling. Wow.
We do try. And then on the sort of educational side, we run a political literacy course, which we take into secondary schools. Started off in a people referral unit in Croydon, which was challenging, but it gave us a sort of scope and it gave us the sort of the test run to then expand into other schools in London and then Dartford, Cambridge, and now also in Yorkshire as well.
And you started this while you were still doing your degree?
Yeah, so I was in my third year at university, and because dissertations and exams weren't stressful enough, I decided to start off something for myself. So I started up this business, Shout Out UK, and once I graduated, I managed to turn it into my full-time job.
What happens when you go into a school and do the political literacy course?
Well, so first of all, we connect with the teacher who sort of says, oh, I don't think my kids will be interested in that. They normally then give it to the kids, ask them, you know, is this something that you'd be interested in? There is normally an overwhelming yes. And then we go in and start delivering. And then the students that we deliver to depends on the school. So some give it to the gifted and talented, some give it to literally the complete opposite. So kids that need a boost up, and some give it to entire years, normally sort of year nines and tens.
And what is it? Is it the nuts and bolts of politics?
Yes, that's what we try and cover.
And how, presumably, do we have to be careful not to look like you're taking sides?
It's a lesson
in the political process, not in the pros and cons of one party or another, or an issue or another.
Yeah, so basically it's divided into three units, because we're an AQA accredited centre, so they get a unit award statement at the end from AQA. And unit one sort of deals with local national politics. So what's an MP, what's a councillor, how you can involve yourself in those two, how you can become one if you want to, how does a bill become a law. Then unit two deals with media literacy, so talk about various different news networks and papers and sort of look at how to critically analyse the media, so that just because something has a million likes doesn't necessarily make it fact or gospel. There are various different opinions, and there's always two sides to a story. We also cover very, very basics around political theory. So we do talk about, you know, what is left and what is right wing. So when, I don't know, a paper says that Jeremy Corbyn is dragging Labour to the left, for example, what does that actually mean? And then in unit three deals with public speaking, debating and presentation skills, which are relevant in politics, but you can take to any career you dare choose, and it's relevant. And we thought those things are important because private schools, and when I say private school, I don't mean just any private school, the top private schools teach all of this stuff. And the majority of us don't get it. And then you can see how the ones that have this information end up going into politics and things like that. And because they understand how the system works, they understand how politics works, they naturally have more power than people that don't, because you know how to work the system to your favour.
David, to what extent do you think technology and the internet and sites like yours are making people more politically literate? Is there a risk that actually they become more siloised and only seeing news stories, campaigns, which basically they already agree with?
I think the honest answer is both, isn't it? And I guess that's one of the things that we recognise a responsibility to try and make sure it's more the former, more about learning and increasing understanding rather than just kind of like having your own prejudices reinforced.
Yeah.
But we definitely do see a lot of that. I hear from a lot of 38 Degrees members who are in a dialogue with their Member of Parliament who didn't know who their Member of Parliament was before. For example, during our campaign against the cuts to tax credits, we were asking people when they signed the petition to indicate if they were directly affected by cuts to tax credits, and then supported those people to go and organise meetings with their MPs. And that was definitely a demographic who most politicians would say, like, apathetic, aren't going to engage. That's one of the reasons they thought they could get away with those cuts to tax credits in the first place.
I think a lot of people assume that young people aren't interested because young people haven't engaged en masse with politics for a long time. And it's that kind of argument that, you know, young people are interested. We are interested in issues like climate change or the NHS or all of these kind of things. But it's like banging your head against a brick wall. When you turn 18, you're told you need to vote, you need to engage. But we don't have a clue how the system works. It's the equivalent of giving someone that has never studied Mandarin a book in Mandarin. The pictures could be beautiful. You might tell them it's the best thing ever to read, but they could try and read it. But if they can't, they'll put it down and never pick it up again. And that's, for me, how politics is. You know, you see people that are trying to engage, but because it's become so convoluted, and when you see politicians speaking in Parliament, on BBC, you know, Parliament, they almost seem like something cut out of the 1400s in the way they sort of talk and debate. And all that stuff puts young people off. And
I think it just puts people off. And I speak to readers of the Red Box email who, it's from outside Westminster, you know, what I would call a normal person. And they say things like, oh, I don't really get politics, or I don't do politics. And I quite like how you explain it, and there's some jokes, but it's not really my, you know, it's not really my thing, or I don't understand it. You do understand, yeah, politics is everyone. You do understand it. I suppose the risk sometimes is if they go through that whole process and then something doesn't happen at the end of it, and they think, oh, what was the point in that? There needs to be some, you know, they can't win every campaign, but some sort of sense that they are.
Yes, you can.
You can win every campaign, yes. But you've got a 100%.
Yes, I do.
There we are.
that means she's good at selecting.
Yes, exactly.
I'm just very good at campaigns.
I remember when I was on local papers, you never launched a campaign. You didn't know you were going to win. So
Well, I mean, it does make it, you know, a bit nerve-wracking. I mean, I'm known for being a really successful campaigner. What if I set this off and it doesn't happen? It would just be awful. But it did. It's fine.
No, the statue's interesting because the statue is quite an old school thing in the, you know, is what they did in the olden days. But in terms of its...
Well, it's become very modern.
It's a high profile, you know, and if actually lots of school children do come into Parliament and have tours and that sort of thing. And if they, you know, have a walk around Parliament Square outside... That is quite a big, you know, it is literally a symbolic thing. But yeah, it feels quite an old-fashioned aim.
Well, I mean, I think that's quite an old-fashioned view, if you don't mind my saying
well,
so.
Well, that is fine.
Because if you look at what's going on, you know, for example, in America, with all the debate about the Confederate statues, you know, the idea of representation is something that people care about a lot. And I think the reason that we have, you know, sort of feel like statues are old fashioned is because they just sort of seem like they're part of the furniture rather than like, you know, a white man might be seen as part of the furniture. We don't really notice them. And, you know, it sort of says a lot to me that I've been in Parliament Square so many times and it was only this one particular time I suddenly realized, hang on a minute, they're all men. How is this possible? I think it was 2016. I can't believe someone hasn't done anything about it. And just because statues aren't there sort of consciously trying to push a certain message, that doesn't mean that they're not pushing a message.
Absolutely. And if there are kids who go to Parliament Square and they look around and, you know, a young girl thinks, oh, I might want to become an MP. But it's only the men who get so far up that they get a statue. That's such a strong message.
One of the things that I really wanted for this statue is to try to replicate what has happened with Gandhi. If you go to Parliament Square, there will always be people taking selfies with Gandhi because it's one of the statues that's kind of accessible. You can stand up on the steps next to him and put your arms around him. And, you know, I've seen people telling their kids about who Gandhi was. You know, it's such an incredible thing to have there. And that's what I wanted to have for the suffrage statue so that, you know, young children could interact with it. And parents could say, you know, that was the woman who meant that, you know, talking to a young girl, that's why you can vote. You know, she had to fight for that.
I would say it's so much better because the Churchill one is so inaccessible. You can you can't even really see it if you're in Parliament Square because it's so high up. I completely agree. I think that's sort of, it's become a much nicer space, that. David, what do you think about this idea in particular of teaching politics in school? Is it possible to teach politics?
To an extent, I think. I mean, politics isn't it? Politics has rules, has concepts, and it's definitely a benefit for people to understand them. But I think you also learn politics by experiencing it. You learn democracy by experiencing it, and so I think there's also a role alongside that formal education. I think for schools to be thinking about how they can actually operate democratically, give kids a say in how the schools run, so they get to experience politics. And also, I think there's a role for everyone in participating and learning by doing.
I was just going to say that. I mean, yeah, I agree with you. I think we do need schools to take part of, but it needs to be in partnership with. I think having people engage in it and learning and participating and so forth, yes, that's all well and good, but most people don't. You know, you've got 50-year-olds that have never engaged in politics, and the only time they have is because they need to pay their taxes, or they have some quarrel with a councillor about bins or something like that.
Yeah.
That's most people. You know, what we're talking about today isn't what most people deal with on a regular basis, although we might want to think that.
Just before we wind up, because I'm conscious of we've only run out of time, we've been talking about what you can do from outside the political process, but would any of you ever take the leap and actually become an MP?
No.
Oh, I'd be very surprised if they'd have me. No.
Okay.
Not for the moment, no.
It's the politician's
answer.
That's a non-denial denial. Okay. Yeah,
no, I think the more, I mean, I'm 25, so I've still got a long way to go, but I think the more I run Shadow, the more I'm involved in this world, I think the more I get pushed away from
politics. Have you ever been asked?
I was asked to stand as a for the London Assembly, and I decided not to.
And what put you off?
What put me off is party politics, actually. I like being able to be 100% authentic to what I believe in.
You need to become Prime Minister in that case, and you can do what you like. Although the current incumbent
is not
always the case. Well, I think that's all we've got time for this week. As ever, do sign up to my morning email briefing at thetimes.co.uk. Let us know about any of the issues we've been talking about this week, or if there are any questions about politics that you'd like answered, then get in touch, redbox@thetimes.co.uk, or tweet @timesredbox. But for now, from
selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Caroline, David, Matteo, and me, it's goodbye.
Thank you for downloading. To discover more, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.